It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Buffer, episode number 9. Mike Ellis and I bring two clips of something sporty each with us. We bring a sports book as well, and one of us gets to choose a documentary. It's my choice. This episode, Mike, how's things? All good?
You all good, Steph? Yeah, very well. Thanks, mate. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. Not bad this week. It's been a decent one. Ellis, you all right?
Absolutely brilliant. Oh, yeah. Very, very good mood. Love a bit of sun.
I was just saying, wasn't it, before we started recording, that your skin looks lovely. You said it was the ambient light in the room.
It is the ambient light. I'd love to have the kind of skin you have, Mike, if I'm honest. Look at that.
I've had a few makeup artists tell me on set that I've got lovely, lovely skin.
I was there when it happened, actually, one of the times. I can independently verify that.
I've got lovely skin. After the lockdown's finished, I can run and have a feel of my skin. Come over.
Did you ever have acne or anything as a teenager?
Oh, yeah. When I had acne in the 80s, mate, I mean, I remember Oxy 10 and Oxy 20.
Yeah, Biactol.
Basically burn your skin off. You know, yeah. None of that bollocks witch hazel stuff in the 80s. It was, just a nuclear option, wasn't it? Well, I mean, there was Age of Star Wars and Ronald Reagan. There was, you know, it was Blitz Those Zits was the title, wasn't it?
Yeah, you'd still end up with acne.
Yes.
But in the parts where you hadn't had acne before, that looked burnt.
Oh, man. I once, this is between friends and whoever's listening. I once had a spot on my scrotum. I thought it was a spot, anyway. And right. I put Oxy 10 on there, and that was a game changer. I'm telling you that for nothing. Anyway.
How do you explain that as well? You've got to keep quiet about it, haven't you? You can't scream in pain. You've just got to heroically carry on and pretend it never happened.
Get on with it. It's like the time when in my bodybuilding days, I was shaving my chest in the shower.
Yeah.
With the Gillette Mac 2. Yeah. And my girlfriend at the time called me, and as I turned to listen to what she was saying, I took the end of my nipple off.
Yes.
And
oh, my goodness.
All I could see in the end of this Gillette Mac 2 razor was just the end of my nipple jammed between the two blades. And I bled profusely. I bled like I imagine a Shepto Mallet pig would bleed.
Oh, good grief.
Oh, my God. Does it grow back?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh. Oh. Just a bit. It's just stung a bit for a while.
I experimented with a personal trainer the start of the year before lockdown.
What do you mean you experimented with them?
That sounds worse than you meant it to, I think.
And, we were doing our like third weightlifting session.
Yeah,
and, I'd love to see that.
And at the end of it, I said, "Oh, my friend Mike has done a lot of weightlifting in his day, and he told me once." that it's not a proper weightlifting session if you can hold your bottle of shampoo in the shower.
He's bang on.
Afterwards, I said I should be so sore now.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be able to grip a bottle of Vidal Sassoon. But I feel perfectly fine.
A good workout. You have to sort of prop your elbow in the cubicle, put it above so your elbow's above your head.
Yeah.
And then just let your hand sort of flop onto your hair to clean it because you've got nothing in your arms. And then you get in your car and you can't operate the clutch because you shake so much.
And then
when you get home, if you need to go for a number two, you're basically like a bombardier from the Second World War over Dresden. You just got to aim and drop from a great height because you just can't squat down slowly.
Well, I said, when am I going to get to that stage then? When are we going to do that kind of stuff? And he went, you're not going to be doing that kind of stuff with me. He sort of sat me down. He said, so what was it your friend said? I said, I shouldn't be able to grip onto a bottle of shampoo in the shower. I should be so tired. And that then is the sign of a good workout. And he said, right, no, I'm not going to do
that. He's one of those namby-pamby new... He probably talked about your core strength that he ain't doing a plank the prick. Did he?
Yeah, there's a bit of that.
Your transverse abs. Well, let's do a bit of planking first, shall we? Oh, yeah, I remember that time when Arnold Schwarzenegger did loads of planking before the Mr. Olympia in the 70s. You absolute twat. Put down the quinoa, there'll be no planking going on my watch, my friend. Pass me the 46-kilo dumbbells and shut up. Take the 35 quid I'm bunging you and shut the fuck up. Just hold my towel and shut up. And take those fucking MP3s out while you're there as well.
Fifty percent of me wants you as a personal trainer. The other 50% thinks it's a very, very bad idea.
We'd have fun. I'm telling that for nothing.
I'm sure we'd have fun. That's
great time.
I don't want to get severely injured. But see, I don't want to be sort of.
No, we'd be set. Well, you would be in pain, but you wouldn't be injured.
That's right. Okay.
You'd be in extreme pain. Soreness,
I can cope with. DOMS, is that what it's called?
Delayed onset muscle soreness. Yeah. Yeah, two days after my squatting session, you would not be able to walk anywhere. You'd just stay in bed all day with like bags of frozen peas on your thighs.
It's just I've got stuff to do.
Well, just...
I can't
make sure your squats are 2 days before rest day.
Yes.
And then when your missus wants to go and do stuff with the kids on rest day, say, I can't, love. I'm lying in the bed with frozen peas on my legs all day.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can devote that much time to DOMS, I'm afraid. So I'm gonna have to take the namby pamby option.
There we go. Keep
I'd love to see what you as, if, with my body.
This is the problem with personal trainers these days, right?
Go on.
Yeah.
Whatever the latest fad is, that's what they do, right? So it's going to be kettlebells or fucking tension bands or core abs or all this bullshit, right? There's certain things that I haven't changed. Immutable truths. Right?
Yeah.
If you want to get stronger, lift heavier weights, right? If you want to get faster, go for a run.
Yeah.
Right? You didn't see that Perseus wasn't doing core abs.
I would say, though, that science has changed. Training has clearly improved.
Right. What does your personal trainer look like? Don't tell me. I'll tell you what your personal trainer
looks like. Yes, go on.
Your personal trainer max is 12 stones.
Well, he plays a lot of tennis.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Well, there we go. There we go. If you look like a tennis player, mate, you crack on. Tennis.
I just...
Do you want to see Ilya Nastasia in a pair of Speedos?
No. Clearly training has improved because look at the difference in physique between...
Joe Wicks and Mr. Motivator.
Yeah, great example. Or Merv the Swerve and any rugby player post the... 2000.
Maybe you're talking about physiques now. So I would compare someone like Bob Paris or Frank Zane or Arnold in his pomp.
Yeah.
Right. Compare them against somebody now. Because I think professional bodybuilding now we're not doing bodybuilding today, right? But it's gone too much the other way. The blokes are mass monsters now. They're all 300 pounds plus.
Yeah.
But you look back in the 80s, the glory years of bodybuilding. Some of the finest physiques you'll ever see. And not a transverse ab in sight.
Aren't there certain exercises that have been discredited? I'm thinking of the kind of sit-ups we used to do.
Oh, here we go. Don't do them
commandment
straight
legs. Under 12s and
don't do 12 down behind your
12s.
Head.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah. I mean, it didn't hurt Arnold Schwarzenegger or Sean Ray, but I'm sure if Tennis Boy tells you to only do pull-downs to your chest, then he's the bloke to listen to. And plus, he's a British tennis player. Do you know what that means? Do you know what that means? It means he turned up for tennis once. He's in the team because he turned up. Tennis player.
I love the idea of my 3 months, my body is a blank canvas, giving Mike Bubbins license
carte
to create.
Blanche.
I guarantee you now, right, if someone wants to get behind this, if you gave me 12 weeks of your time,
yeah,
I would transform you.
Right, okay.
But into what?
Into Ellis Shane's 2.0. Right? Better than he was before. Better, stronger,
shredded. Right, Mike, you are first up for round number one. What have we got?
Right, this fella, I'll be honest with you, a year ago I'd never heard of him. I have golf lessons on a fairly regular basis with a lovely man called John Hastings, I may have mentioned before. And John was telling me who his favourite golfers were. And he said, my number one golfer is Mo Norman. I said, do you mean Greg Norman? He said, no, Mo Norman.
You corrected your golf tutor on golfers. Yeah. Strong start.
I said, I've never heard of Mo Norman, right? So he said, right, go home and look him up. It's just such an interesting story. I'll just give a quick bit of preamble. I think nowadays he'd be recognised fairly early on in his life that he had he was autistic or he had Asperger's. The time that he was born, that sort of thing wasn't diagnosed. He was just seen as different and strange and a bit odd. Was just a fabulously talented golfer who never had a lesson, had a swing that was completely unique. Like Tiger Woods said only two people in history had ever owned their golf swing.
Yeah.
I think one was Ben Hogan, he said, and the other one was Mo Norman. John worked as a on the sort of satellite tour in the States in the 80s, but also was Craig Stadler's caddy to make ends meet. And he said that Mo Norman, if they ever played in Canada, we'll get to that in a second after the clip, whenever they played in Canada, if Mo Norman was at a tournament, all the pros would line up to watch Mo Norman hit a golf ball.
Right here. First foot comes straight down. The club is going further behind my back on my downswing. This is pointing. Never this. It's always... My left arm's way higher than my right. Way higher. You can always put the club in this way. Never, you know, the other way. That would fall there. My club would always fall. Never in front of me. Always back behind me.
A really, really unique swing. If you play golf or don't play golf, you're talking about a man who doesn't do anything the way that you're taught to play golf. So he's got
that's what I was going to say. Because I don't play golf, but I had one lesson at a driving range a few months ago.
With a tennis tutor.
He broke all the rules and did all the stuff that I was told I wasn't meant to do.
That's the thing. And I think his autism really, I hate to say the words, it helped him. But he had such a unique way of seeing, when listening to the way he talks about golf, one thing he said, he would picture a train track between his ball and the flag that was electrified. And he had to keep the ball off the electric rails. So he had to keep it, and they called him Pipeline because he was so straight when he hit a golf ball. So he played in the 50s. I think he was back-to-back amateur champion in Canada in the 50s.
Right.
On the back of that, joined the professional tour.
Okay.
Went down to the States in around 1960. But got basically bullied, was bullied out of it. People took the piss out of the way that he looked and the way that he dressed and the way that he swung, the way he repeated himself all the time and spoke in these very staccato sentences. Didn't like it, came back to Canada, to Ontario, a little place called Kitchener, and basically for the rest of his career only played within a driving distance of his house. That's where he... But according to John, I didn't read this, John told me this bit about Mo, was that he would... if he won a tournament, which he usually did, he wouldn't stick around for the prize money or the presentation, didn't like crowds, didn't like eye contact. He would get in his car, he would drive to the nearest McDonald's, he'd get a drive-through, he would drive home, eat his food, go to sleep, and that was it. That's all he did, right? But just so accurate, there's a bit there where There's a great story when he played with Sam Snead, who was another very famous golfer. This is a great story. He played with Sam Snead in Canada at a game. Sam Snead, another pro that I can't remember, and Mo Norman. And they're on the tee there. It's about 225 away from the tee is a creek running across the fairway. So Sam Snead and the other fella get irons out to pitch up short. And Mo Norman takes his driver up, right? So Sam says, because he's young at the time, and Sam's trying to give him a bit of advice, he said, listen, Mo, this is not a drivable green. You know, you can play up short, play to the green. He said, you won't reach the green from here.
Yeah.
He said, I don't want to reach the green. I'm aiming for the bridge. And there was a footbridge, like a 3-foot-wide footbridge over the creek. And he drove over that. So he drove short, bounced about 3 times, over the footbridge.
Whoa.
And that's the way that he played the game. And there's one of the pros said that once he watched him hit, I think, 50 balls at the 250-yard marker on a driving range.
Yeah.
And I think of the 50 balls, I think 20 hit the marker.
Right.
And like 30 were close.
My God.
He would just be so straight. Bang, 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 bang. But he was just, these days, you know, he would be recognised for what he is. You know, a genius. But he broke all sorts of course records. But in Canada, he hit 3 rounds in the 50s. He hit three rounds at 61.
Yeah.
It's just a crazy, like his record in Canada was absolutely insane. When they brought the senior tour into Canadian golf, in I think 1979, Mo Norman entered. He won it in 79, 80, 81, 82, 83, 84, 85, came fifth in 86 and won it again in 87.
I do love any very successful sports person with an unorthodox technique.
Mm.
There's something so refreshing about it. I'm off the top of my head, the way Michael Johnson used to run the gate, the way you were almost leaning back.
Short stride pattern as well.
It just looks wrong. And yet he is destroying all the records. He's winning gold medals. Emil Zatopek, the greatest distance runner of all time. If you look at him running, he looks, what a mess. Yeah, yeah. You know, all over the place. He used to say, well, I'm not being, you know, it's not a race in who looks the most beautiful.
It makes you wonder when you get coached and coached and coached to death, right? That when people coach themselves and develop a style that works for them, because that's all that matters, isn't it? I mean, in sport, the only important thing is the end product.
Yes.
A musical example is, as someone who can play the guitar, Jimi Hendrix's technique is often quite sloppy.
Right.
But it sounds amazing, and so...
He's also playing a right-handed guitar upside down, though, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. But he breaks rules and he does things that a guitar teacher, if he was teaching someone who was 12, would say that he mustn't do. But then obviously it works for him and it sounds amazing. And
there's a great story about Mo Norman, because you take things, I suppose one part of autism or Asperger's is you can take things very literally. So they were playing on one round, and he says to his caddy, you know, how far's the pin? He says, you'll need... a 9-iron and a driver. Okay. So he hit the 9-iron off the tee and then drove the green off the fairway, which I love. You know, taking the 9-iron off the tee. So I'd never heard of, never heard of it, and I just thought, I'm always thinking of ideas for, you know, films and TV series and documentaries and stuff. I thought, God, that'd be such a good story that this bloke was recognised as being just the best at hitting a golf ball, but... You know, he couldn't get beyond playing within a drive of Kitchener, Ontario. Be a great story. So I looked into if anyone owned the rights for it. We'll call, you know, in the business, you know, has anyone got an option on it or anyone? And Wayne Gretzky. This is interesting. So Wayne Gretzky, probably the best hockey player ever.
Yeah,
owns the rights and is in production of the Mo Norman life story.
Great minds.
I think of myself as the Gretzky of Cardiff, of extra rugby players in Cardiff.
My choice for round one is a footballer phoning up a football phone-in, which is always a recipe for something good. This is Robbie Savage phoning up football phone-in in South Wales on a radio station that was called Real Radio. He'd been dropped from the Wales squad. And he's having a chat with former Wales international Leighton James.
Have you had a rejection from Tosh then?
I've not spoken. Not one word.
Have you written to him?
Right. I think my written to him.
Yes or no?
I've seen him in school.
It's a simple question. Well, you just said you
just
Oi, don't cut me off.
You want to do face to face?
Just suggested something then.
Why don't
you get in your car and drive down there then?
I'm prepared to do anything I can
to
play my country again.
Do it then.
Don't come on here
and say I'm prepared to do it. You've had 6 months to do that. Does that never cross your mind?
6 months to walk in. I'm not saying you're going to walk in. To be humbled in front of all the lads.
Nobody's saying that. Get off your soapbox. Nobody's saying that.
You weren't a bad player. You weren't the greatest player in the world.
I never professed to be.
You weren't the greatest player in the world. You were technically right, but you weren't the best tackler. You wouldn't go for 50-50s as far as my father remembers.
Well, I'll tell you something,
son. I'll tell you that now. If I play against you these days...
This used to get played in the office I used to work in, because I used to work in a sports office as a journalist. And I think from the day that this went out, this was played almost on a daily basis, just to lift morale.
Were you a sports journalist, Steph?
Occasionally.
It never comes across.
The moment where Leighton James asks Robbie Savage to write to John Toshack.
There are two things. He has a go at him for not writing John Toshack a letter, asking why he's not being selected for the squad. And also, Robbie Savage, I think quite reasonably, says, what sort of manager, modern day manager, doesn't have a mobile phone? And Leighton James goes, he's got no need for a mobile phone. Why should he have a mobile phone?
Leighton kept calling him son all the time.
Yeah.
What?
You wouldn't have caught me, son.
What a wanker's trick. I'd be taking the first taxi to the studio, honestly.
Robbie says, well, you know, I mean, I'd attack. I didn't see you play, but my dad said you didn't like to get stuck in.
You didn't go into 50-50s, according to my dad.
Yeah, I'd have tackled you.
Oh, brilliant.
And then you wouldn't have caught me, son. You wouldn't have caught me. And it is.
Like Dad said, you're full of shit, basically.
That's basically it. It's pretty. I never saw you play, but my dad said you were awful. He said you were technical. Super. You were technical.
Well, I thought Robbie said you were technical.
Robbie came across quite well, because he sort of says, I'm not the most gifted player in the world. Well, I'll work hard, and I pass to players who are more skillful than me.
Yeah.
Well, I don't watch a lot of football, but when they built the Millennium Stadium, I was building it, I went down to see two Wales games. I think Wales played Brazil.
Oh, yeah. I was
and I went to go and see, I think it was Wales, Norway, maybe?
I remember. It was one of the first ones, yeah.
And I don't know a great deal about football. I watched Robbie Savage go from 18-yard box to 18-yard box for 90 minutes, like a banshee. He must have done 15K, 20K running.
You can level lots of things at Robbie Savage. You cannot level that he was ever unfit.
His work rate was phenomenal.
His work rate was insane. And also, he knew what his job was.
Hmm.
Leighton James, I think it's actually... If you're under the age of 45, it's easy to forget just how good Leighton James was as a player.
Who did he play for?
He played for the Swans under Toshack. He played for Derby and Burnley. There were some Burnley fans in my local pub a few months ago, because they played Palace. And I got chatting
to them.
Bunch
of Northern Ponces. What were
you
doing there?
I said, oh, well, you know, whenever I think of Burnley, I think of Leighton James.
Yeah.
And they were all in their 50s and 60s, and they all went world class. He was the best winger in Europe in his day,
yeah.
And he was a really good player for Wales.
What was Leighton's problem with Robbie? Was it not personal?
Well, Leighton and John Toshack were teammates for Wales in the 70s, and also then Toshack, when he was player manager of the Swans, Leighton was in his team. You know, the Swansea's most successful side of the early 80s, the one that went, you know, fourth division to first division and came sixth in the first division. So, you know, they go back a long way, those two. But
I remember my dad telling me in the week a couple of great stories. One was that I didn't realise that before I came on the scene, so sort of 1970, 71, around that time.
Yeah.
My dad and my mum would go to see Cardiff City play at Ninia Park, which I didn't know. And mum would wear, I think I told you, mum would wear because she was a school teacher at the time, she'd wear a blonde wig so nobody can recognise, you know, the kids that she taught wouldn't be able to recognise her, like standing in the Bob Bank. And my dad...
What the fuck?
My old man should be a Swansea fan. I said, not now, mum. Right, so... But then he listened to the pod last week, and he told me about the time when he had a run-in with the Millwall fans.
Wow.
I was like, I said, what? And he said it was a Cardiff Millwall game.
Yeah.
He said, and one of these, what was it, F Troop?
Yeah, yeah.
One of these youngsters, I don't know if he was an F Troop or the Treatment, but he was a young hooligan, is running through, I don't know what part of the stand it was in, but knocked this lady over and knocked her a cup of tea everywhere, being a bit of a dick. So my old man, being my old man, grabbed this bloke by the neck, right?
So next street thing, justice.
Yeah, well, just to grip and say, what you're doing, sort of thing. So next thing, there's about 8 or 9 of these Millwall lads and my dad. And my dad thinks I'm going to get a shoe in here. This is what's going to happen next. And then two of the Cardiff City team, one was a Scottish player and one was, I think, a Welsh boy, basically stepped into the stand. This is the end of the first half. Stepped into the stand to back my dad up, at which point the Cardiff City fans have obviously got the players' backs as well. So that's all sorted.
Come on, Harry the dog.
But also...
Harry the dog.
just
go on.
You've got to be back and play a group in the morning. Come on.
It is quite rare.
That's on your CV.
It is quite rare that the players themselves get involved. I remember Carragher doing this with Adrian Durham on TalkSport.
Yes.
Adrian Durham had accused Carragher of lacking bottle.
Yes.
So Carragher called him up and said, what are you talking about? And, you know, stood his ground. And did Lampard?
I think Frank
well?
Lampard phoned up something, didn't he?
Yeah.
TalkSport off the top of my
I think
head.
It might have been Adrian Durham again, actually. Yeah. Adrian Durham's previous, this kind of thing.
I listened to that, and I didn't think Robbie Savage came off badly from that at all.
No, and also it's the pre-606 media Robbie Savage. So he comes across as being quite meek.
Yes, he does,
and
now,
and I had the pleasure of interviewing Robbie Savage last week. I'd never met him before.
Yeah.
And you know, we started recording at 1:30. I asked my first question at 1:33. I didn't say anything then, apart from thanking him for coming on the podcast at 3:20. Because, you know, I've got a lot of time for Robbie. I like his punditry.
Yeah.
But he just doesn't stop talking. And he, you know, nowadays he would give both barrels to Leighton James because
that's
he does that
role,
on 6 or 6 every
yeah.
week
yeah.
and that is
yeah.
his role. And he did it to me. So he... You know, he played with Ryan Giggs in the class of 92. I said, so do you think that Ryan has got the attributes to be a successful Wales manager?
Yeah.
And he went, well, what do you think, Ellis? And he completely turned the
Brilliant.
Conversation
Brilliant.
Back on me. And I got absolutely savaged. Like,
Brilliant.
Like I got savved. And because I hadn't expected to be answering the questions. I felt like some... Paul Sod is on the way back from Stoke away. It's because he's had a few cans. He decided to call 6:06.
When he's driving the gigs or driving from gigs, to put 6:06 on and listen to punters, you know, someone who, and I'm not knocking truck drivers, but someone who's a truck driver taking complete umbrage with a particular formation.
Yeah,
yeah.
And
yeah,
having
yeah.
this brilliant idea how the game should be played and what that manager should be doing with the team, right? And then. At what point do you stop indulging those people? Because obviously you've got to get people phoning in and it's nice to have the banter. But you must want to say at some point, mate, no offence, but you're speaking out of your arse. Like, you don't know what you're talking about.
What Robbie doesn't say in that clip, which is what he means, but he doesn't say it in so many words, is, listen, we have a very shallow player base because Wales is a small country.
Yeah.
It's a strange decision that he doesn't select me when I'm playing for Blackburn Rovers, who came sixth that season and qualified for the UEFA Cup.
Perhaps you're playing with better players, Robbie. Perhaps you're playing with better players.
Two guys.
But it's also a real... It's a bit of a wanker's trick. You know, all right, then who are you better than then? You know, it could be a comedy booker. It might be a boss. It might be a football manager.
Yeah.
It might be a pundit. For him to say to Robbie on air, you know, who are you better than then?
The presenter says, well, actually, there is... Even if you include... Kumas and Simon Davis and Giggs on the left-hand side, there is still a gap in
space.
That. And he goes, who do you put that? Who would you pick? And he goes, well, I would pick Robbie Savage.
Yeah, I took Robbie's on the phone.
He did. That was a classic, wasn't it? And, but then Leighton's like, oh, you're all ganging up on me, eh?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, it's like that, is it?
Yeah,
get me on you, you can all gang on me, is it? Right, oh, I get it, that's right, fair enough, yeah. Oh, like, have a go at Leighton Day, is it? Let's fucking have a go at Leighton, have a pop of Leighton today, is it? Leighton, just hang on a minute, mate. Oh, I fucking reading your mail, mate. Oh, I get new. Oh, sunshine. I can fucking suss you out.
It reminded me of being in pubs when someone is taking the piss out of one of the regulars, yeah, and it's really changes. Funny until about 10:30.
Yes.
When he's had one too many, and now you're like, oh God, there's going to be a fucking fight now. Because we've been taking the piss out of the fact that he orders roast potatoes and boiled potatoes for his Sunday dinner. I mean, this was all funny an hour ago, but now his face is red.
All right, I get it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Bullies, you are. See, boys, bullies, you are coming in here. Just because I like Dauphinoise potatoes, boiled potatoes, Pembrokeshire new potatoes, I'll eat any. And my wife knows that, and my friends and family who love me, my loved ones know that. But that boy, oh, bully, oh.
Fuck off, Dave. You've seen him eat a mash bat. We know what we're talking about, man.
Bullying Malcolm, yeah. Very, very
mash boy,
big
mash
of
boy. Oh, yeah, have a go with me because I haven't got nice hair like you, is it, Rob?
Yeah.
Is it, Rob? With your fucking shampoo and your long hair and their highlights. I can see the bottom of you. What are you talking about, man? 50-50. 50-50, indeed.
You know, because Robbie, he has got to share a dressing room with those players, so it puts him in such a difficult position.
Say, he's brilliant. Drop?
Still my favourite part, though, is just... Have you written...
Write him a letter.
Like we're in school. We're going to write to him.
Yes.
I say to my missus, my lovely wife's an English... was an English teacher. She's a deputy head now. Well done, Kel. It saves me having to have a job. Right, so... but they still, as part of GCSE in this country, right? GCSE English, yes. Right? Write a letter to your local MP explaining that. I said, fuck me, these kids have never seen a pen. What are they going to write? And it's like, how are you going to write stuff? Like your address, top left corner, then their address, and then the tagline, and then dear so-and-so. I said, Kelly, no one's writing letters, right? Who's writing letters to anybody? Apart from Robbie Savage to John Toshack, no one's writing letters.
English GCSE, question 3. You are a disgruntled Premier League footballer.
Your manager has just dropped you from the national setup.
Yeah.
He does not have a mobile phone.
We'll get his address then.
Please write 4 paragraphs.
Or you can get his address off the FAW. Get a post box or something.
Some of his reasoning, it sounds like two drunk men arguing.
He sounds like he's having a kebab in the second half. There's fucking chili sauce on here, man. I told him, what?
And the way he gets...
I said garlic sauce.
And the way he gets Robbie to admit that he hasn't written John Toshack a letter.
Brilliant.
Well, there you go, then. You clearly don't want to play for your country. Oh, so you want to play for your country, do you? But you can't be bothered to buy a stamp.
Leighton, I didn't have a stamp.
You could borrow a stamp.
I didn't have a stamp.
Can I ask you a question, Robbie? Can I ask you a question? You play for Blackburn. I'm assuming you don't live in the town itself. You probably live in the outskirts of some small village in Lancashire. Does your village have a shop? Yeah? Well, could you buy yourself an envelope and a stamp? Does your village have a post box, Robbie? Do you pass a post box on your way into training on a daily basis?
Well, there we are then. International footballer, Robin, you can't afford 21p for the first class stamp, is it?
Yeah. Go second class is not a fixture for 3 months. All right, then it'll take a day longer to arrive. That's how much you want to play for your country, is it?
Late in. Great
clip.
Oh, dear. Right, Alice, round number one. What have you gone for this week?
You hear this phrase said an awful lot, especially in contact sports, of playing through the pain, taking one for the team. What's that Vince Lombardi quote, Bubs?
I don't expect anyone to play injured, but I expect everyone to play hurt.
I think especially sports like rugby union and, or rugby league, and boxing, you know, there are famous examples. But I cannot think of a better example of an athlete putting their body on the line.
She knows what to do. She will go when she is ready. Terry Slug is hurt. She is hurt badly. Well, John, we saw her lifting after the first ball. She has either twisted her ankle or something worse. She hurt herself on the first ball.
Probably the last thing she should have done was buzz again, but she did, and now she is in a lot of pain.
The amazing thing about it, though, John, she raised her hands overhead. Her head, she finished the ball.
So there we have it. That's Kerry Strug at the 1996 Atalanta Olympics. So she has torn her ligaments in the first jump,
right,
on the vault. But then because the rest of her teammates had just fallen apart, she is forced to jump again. And in the interval between her two vaults, she asked her coach, do we need this? And they said, Kerry, the coach said, Kerry, we need you to go one more time. We need you one more time for the gold. You can do it. You better do it. She landed the vault briefly on both feet, almost instantly hopping onto her only good foot, saluting the judges. Because she's got to do that to complete the jump. Now, yes. the amount of courage involves is just incredible.
Also, the force you're under there, that's not like walking on a sprained ankle.
No.
The height you're coming down from there at that speed is like, you'd be like coming out of a car at 30 miles an hour.
So, you know, she's still seen, it's one of the great Olympic moments, you know, when they do those countdown.
Was she actually badly injured there, or was it?
Yeah,
it was ligament damage.
They had to carry her onto the podium to get a medal.
Yeah, but I've seen that happen before when people haven't been injured. They're just playing up for the cameras. I'm just wondering.
Her leg is in a cast.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough.
You'd have been telling Derek Redmond to hurry up.
Look, Derek, get up.
But you talk to people who've torn their ACL, and they will say that it's worse than breaking a bone.
I tore my ankle. Like, I broke my bone. I broke my left leg in two places, both bones.
Yeah.
And that was about 6 weeks in a full cast and probably about 6 weeks of rehab. I was 18, so it healed pretty quick. But I then tore my ligaments in my ankle badly when I was about 19, 20.
Yeah.
And no shit, I had trouble with my ankles for the rest of my rugby career, like for the next 10 years.
Yeah.
I'd have wear various braces and strap my ankles and strap my boot to my socks and all sorts of weird stuff. I mean, ankle ligaments, and that's running around a rugby pitch. That's not flipping.
Yeah.
Flying off a box from height and landing on a mat like that. That's crazy what she did there.
I'm trying to imagine her walk to do that final jump where her coach has said, you've got to do it or we're not going to win the gold. And her teammates looking imploringly.
You would do it though, Al, wouldn't you? You would. I mean, it's a gold medal Olympics.
I don't know.
You're going to do it.
I don't know.
Of course you would, because what's the option?
Silver.
The option is not to do it. And then,
the option is silver. Bollocks.
What's a silver though, isn't it?
The option is to retire injured.
If you've just got to suck it up for 10 seconds. And watching it was brilliant, but I think any top sports person who put that much into their training for years to get to the Olympics is going to do the same thing, aren't they?
Thomas Hearns broke his hand in the first round when he fought Marvin Hagler, and when he went back to his corner, he told his corner man, he said, I've broken my hand, I've broken my right hand. And his corner man said, no, you haven't. And he went, yes, I have.
Well, Calzaghe broke his hand first round.
Calzaghe broke his hand against Jeff Lacy.
Well, yeah. I wonder what it is about watching sport, do you really admire that? Do you know what I mean? I think people who don't get sport don't get that you admire the fact that people put their well-being on the line.
We had a great argument about this during the 2014 World Cup, Bubs. I don't know if you remember, but Neymar, Brazil's, you know, bright hope, the person their entire World Cup was resting on, broke his back in the quarter-final and then couldn't play in the semi-final against Germany. Which they then went on to lose 7-1.
Wouldn't play.
And that was it. I said he couldn't play. You said he wouldn't play.
Wouldn't. Broke his back.
You said just dose him up on painkillers. Just give him
a year later, he's walking around like Cock of the North. You want to be... They say, well, where's old Limpy?
Limpy.
Polishing her medals.
Go and see old Limpy's gold medal, and she'll regale you with stories about 1996.
Did it hurt? It hurt like fuck, actually.
Yeah. Well, I've been walking lopsided ever since. Silver medal. I mean, obviously, a silver medal is good. I'm not saying silver medal's bad. I'm just saying there's a big difference in having that story and then saying, well, do you know what? We came second. I would have gone on the last jump. My ankle was absolutely killing
really
me.
Hurt.
Oh, God, proper.
It
really
is. Smarting it was.
Fair play. The ankle's fine now. I go running three times a week.
Yeah. 2 weeks later, I was right as rain. That's the irony of it. Fuck off.
This is a paid advert from BetterHelp Therapy Online. Now, we all carry around lots of different sort of stress moments, whether it's like big or small. It could be as huge as, how am I going to pay the mortgage this month? Or, you know, I'm ill, but I don't really want to talk to anybody about that because I don't want to make them feel stressed about it as well. Or, you know, it could be just something as small as, how am I going to get to school pickup in time? I've got a meeting. How do I change that? How do I move that? I forgot to cancel that. And lots of the time we keep it bottled up. And whether it's big or small, it can really start to affect us negatively. And therapy is kind of a safe space to get those things off your chest. So whether it's like coming up with plans to organise your life a little bit better, or whether it's just having someone to talk to about those things you don't want to stress out your mates or your family with.
If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, accessible, affordable and entirely online. You will be matched with a therapist after filling out a brief survey, and you can switch therapists at any time.
Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/distant. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/distant.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Let's do documentaries. It's my turn this time round, and I've gone for a film called 9.79 with a little asterisk next to it. It's by a guy called Daniel Gordon, who's, I didn't realise that I liked a lot of his work already. So there's a few films about sport in North Korea that he's made as well. I didn't realise that he'd made this one. But this is about the 1988 Seoul Olympics, the 100 metres final in that one. And the little asterisk is obviously a reference to Ben Johnson and his disqualification in that race. This kind of traces what happened before, what happened during, and what's happened since to the eight guys who raced in it.
Tario! Let them go first time, and Ben Johnson got a brilliant start. It's Johnson away, it's clear.
They can't get to low.
And Lewis is not going to catch him. Johnson wins it. Lewis second, Christie third. And the world record has gone again.
And that is the greatest 100 metres the world has ever seen.
Just been handed a piece of paper here that if it's right, it'll be the most dramatic story out of these Olympics or perhaps any others.
You've done it again, Steph. You've done it again.
What?
You've picked an absolutely brilliant documentary.
It's... I'd watched it years ago, and sometimes when you've watched something years ago, it's not actually as good as you remember it being.
I had the same thing with Beverly Hills Ninja with Chris Farley. I saw it once in Canada drunk,
yeah.
And I got it on video back here about 6 months later, and it was rubbish. So, sorry, go on.
Ben Johnson, his story is reasonably well known. Probably the most high profile until Lance came along of being a cheat.
I would say still the highest profile ever.
Do you think?
Only because I don't think the Tour de France, as big as it is, has the global impact of 100 metres at the Olympics.
Yeah.
It's the biggest race at the world's biggest sporting event, apart from the World Cup.
Well, it's the marquee event of the marquee athletics tournament, isn't it?
And also, as I vividly remember Seoul 88, because I had measles, so I watched every second of it because I was off school.
Did that rule you out?
It did rule me out, unfortunately, yeah. And I'd run a good time in 87. That was the frustrating thing.
You and the title flash, 14
but the,
seconds.
But the thing with Ben Johnson, for years afterwards, if you cheated at anything, people would be like, oh, Ben Johnson.
And do you know, I always took umbrage with that. And even at the top of that then, I'm not sure if you or Steph used the word cheat.
Me, yeah.
You, Steph, right? And that is like the go-to thing when they describe Ben Johnson.
Yeah.
I never thought that.
Go on.
Because I had enough savvy, even at a young age, to realise, and it's touched upon in that doc.
Yeah.
So the fact that he was strung out and, you know, held up as this, like, sacrificial lamb to the IOC for doping and, you know, becoming the face of drugs in sport and branded a cheat, you know, and it's a cliche, but they started to call him, like, the Jamaican-born sprinter instead of the Canadian sprinter and all this sort of stuff. Washed their hands of him. It was appalling. I just thought the way he was treated was appalling. And what I love that, Doc, because it's like when you watch Batman Begins, right? There's no goodies and baddies. Because there aren't goodies and baddies, are there? Right?
Yeah.
So Ben Johnson's like Christian Bale, right?
Well, he's from Haverford West.
Yeah, he's from Haverford West. And he's in The Machinist.
Yeah.
He lost 8 stone to play The Machinist. Living on crushed apples and water. There's no rights and wrongs, is what I'm saying. It's not black and white. Athletics and sport and life is not black and white, right?
There's that great moment where Des Lynam is handed the sheet of paper.
Yes.
Des Lynam, a broadcaster famous for being unflappable.
Yes.
Raises an eyebrow. So you know that if Lynam's raising an eyebrow, Jonathan Pearce is, you know, he's screaming from the rooftops. So Des Lynam says... Pierce's dick is out. Lynam's eyebrows
up.
Motson's unzipped, but he's not sure which way it's going to go.
The cage is open, but the beast is asleep.
So anyway, and Lynam looks at the camera and says, "Well, if this is true, then this is the greatest scandal in Olympic history." And it was massive. And also, the thing I vividly remember about it is when it was on the news, I remember my mum going, "Well, he's obviously on drugs. Look at him.
Look at his eyes. Look at his eyes.
Everyone became an expert on the side effects of, like, nandrolone.
Yeah.
And he's faster than the rest of them.
Well, the thing with the documentary is the documentary hints quite strongly that he was spiked. And also that there were other people at it.
Yes.
And Ben Johnson, I think, believes that he was spiked. And he believes that he carried the can unfairly and was doing something that everyone else was doing, but he is the fall guy. Yeah. Now, even if he was spiked, because at the start it says, as long as you stop taking your drugs 28 days before the race, they can't catch you. So you do your training on drugs and then you do the race clean. So there's all sorts of theories about why he was caught, because if he'd been doing it properly, he wouldn't have been caught. Yeah, ultimately, he is still a cheat for taking performance-enhancing drugs.
See, I don't think of it as a cheat still. That always just grates on me, that word cheat.
But that's Lance Armstrong's argument, isn't it?
But I wrote papers on this as well when I was in uni.
Yeah.
Only about performance-enhancing drugs. And it's not as black and white as people think. I drew an analogy once with, like, you can be the Swiss bobsled team, right?
Yes.
And you can work in complete secret. You can have the best metals. You can have the best materials. You can have your diet regulated. You can work with the finest sports psychologists and physicians and everything else, right? Your bobsled could be worth millions of dollars, right?
Yeah.
Right. There's nothing even about a playing field there. If you're from a poor country, there's nothing even about that playing field. And I know it's the body, but at what point do you say, okay, well, if you're born at altitude, you've got more red blood cells. You can use oxygen much more readily than someone born at sea level. Yeah. So that's an unfair advantage. You know, what about people who've got to live at altitude for that specific reason? What, you know, when blood doping was allowed, briefly, I think that line changes all the time. And I think Johnson's thing was, don't get me wrong, right? I wouldn't want my son to take steroids. I'm a dad, right? I would have taken him at the time.
Goes against your father's instinct.
Goes against my father's instinct.
Drive him to Durham to get some nandrolone.
You'll stop at the petrol station, get some Hubba Bubba and some roids.
And see, give me some Stanozolol and a Snickers, please, Dad. Actually, it would have been a marathon back in the day. But the whole point, and I think, as I like athletics and I like bodybuilding, and I like, you know, so the weightlifting, you know, that it's not the case. I think a lot of people think drugs equals the easy way out, right? And that's a thing that gets bandied around a lot.
Yeah.
And what was nice about that documentary is one of the doctors there was saying it wasn't the case that, you know, if you worked so hard in a training session, you might be wiped out for 3 days.
Yeah.
Right? But if you took this steroid, you could probably train again that day.
Yeah.
Or certainly the next day. Yeah. Right? So you could train harder and longer. It's not the fact that you're taking shortcuts.
No, you're still training.
You're training harder than people who aren't on gear a lot of the time.
But it was such a big scandal. I think what people thought was happening was that Ben Johnson was quite an average athlete.
Yeah.
And then he was injected with something that turned him into Superman.
And then he was fast.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he was fast. And then you could take, you know, Bill next door and inject him with something. And even though he's a 50-year-old civil servant working for Carmarthen County Council, suddenly then he's able to run.
He's wearing 987.
He's suddenly able to run sub 10 second 100 metres.
Bill's got bronze of the Europeans.
Whereas in reality, it allows you to recover more quickly from your training so you can train even harder.
And you've got to remember, right, this is the thing, right? And you mentioned about Calvin Smith being the only one not tainted with something.
Well, no, it's him and the Brazilian guy who seems to be the coolest person in the
world.
Who
is absolutely adorable.
Robson Da Silva just strikes me as the nicest. I might have missed out on millions.
Absolutely incredible that Robson Da Silva could get to a 100-metre final at the Olympics with about as much cutting edge as your average toddler. He's like, I was just happy to be there, to be honest, and just, I've got a nice life. I had a bad start in the 100-metre final, the race that defined me and defined a generation of sprinters, because I was just thinking about how great my life was. Come on, mate. Go on the B of the bang.
Go on the G of bang.
Yeah.
You got
the bit where he goes, but I sleep at night.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was so lovely, that.
I was like, I didn't cheat, I'm all right with it.
So lovely, that. Because that's the thing, you look at Ben Johnson and he looks...
He looks like he hasn't slept since 1988.
He's like a crushed man, 30 years after the event.
The saddest thing about it is he's in a very modest house.
Yes.
Yeah.
And one of the opening shots of the documentary, which, if I haven't made this explicit already, you must watch because it is a tremendous documentary. But he's in his little basement of his quite modest house, and all of his medals are just in an old cardboard box.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're all tangled together. The ribbons are all tangled.
They're like fan mail, just a huge box of fan mail, some of which he's never opened, you know.
He won gold at the Rome World Championships in 1987 and broke the world record. Then he gets 9.79 in the 88 Olympics, and for 48 hours he's Olympic champion. Nobody came close to 9.79 for a long time. I think it was 11 years before somebody broke the 9.79 barrier, because he had smashed the record. And, you know, he had a tremendous career. He was a brilliant athlete with one of the great rivalries, that Carl Lewis-Ben Johnson rivalry. Yeah. It's up there with McEnroe and Borg, and it's up there with Cohen or Vett. It is a tremendous sporting rivalry, which benefited them both. Because the thing with Carl Lewis, he was never really popular. He wasn't popular with the rest of the America.
He wasn't popular with the rest
of the American team, but also with Carl Lewis. He wasn't particularly popular with the fans, so he never got a big sponsorship deal with one of the really huge companies, you know, McDonald's or Coca-Cola or Pepsi or American Express. He was a bit of an outsider, I think. So where he made his money was those huge European meets where he was paid enormous...
Zurichs and...
He was paid enormous appearance fees. And what drove his appearance fees up was if he was competing against Ben Johnson. If he was racing Ben, you know, that really put bums on seats. The problem with steroids and performance-enhancing drugs is that... You have to clamp down on it, because if you don't, then
everyone
will do
it. As the tennis trainer.
But then
cut down on it. You've been told your trainer again, have you? Cut down on the steroids. Do some more planking.
Ease back on the steroids.
Yeah.
Cut back on the steroids.
Six more burpees, Al. Six more.
If the Olympics said, if the IOC said, all right, then go for it. Make a level playing field. Take what you want. You'd end up with 22-year-olds having heart attacks and dying. That is what would happen. That is.
But running 7 seconds.
Oh, I don't think that would happen.
Running 4 seconds, 100 metres.
Swings and roundabouts.
Well, I think 30-minute marathon.
So while I was doing a bit of weight training, I didn't want to, you know, I've only been drug tested once in my life.
Right.
But I didn't want to get banned, you know. So I would always be reading to see what was banned, what wasn't banned, what could I take.
So you'd take everything up to the point.
A lot of the boys would take ephedrine.
Yeah.
Right. Because that was legal. Yeah. And then they banned ephedrine, so we stopped
taking
it.
That's a stimulant, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's always
like
this...
Super Red Bull.
Yeah, yeah. It's like drinking 10 cans of Red Bull. And they used to have Ultimate Orange. Remember that, Steph?
Ultimate Orange. Brilliant.
Oh, man. It was like... Oh, Christ. Yeah. We used to take like two ephedrines and some Ultimate Orange, and then...
Woof.
If you didn't have a heart attack by half-time, you'd do well. So,
I remember in our school sports day the year later...
Go on.
Boy, you doping?
No, but a boy who'd broken his leg.
Smoking dope.
I mean, I was at primary school. A boy who'd broken his leg in, like, year four. He went 100 metres, rumours of school. Yeah, Craig's been on anabolic steroids. He'd been taking anabolic steroids.
The whole broken leg was a ruse.
I remember telling my dad when I got home.
He's not 5 seconds off his time.
I said, Neil Morgan told me that Craig has broken his leg and he's on anabolic steroids and he won 100 metres. My dad was like, of course he's not on anabolics. He's 8 years old. He's not even running for the county. He's not very good on anabolic steroids. He's not even running for the county. Come on.
He's blood doping. He's blood doping. Yeah.
No, serious. I saw him taking tablets at dinner time. The dinner ladies told him off for taking his tablets. It was anabolic steroids.
A couple of hay fever pills.
No, seriously, the Pyroton makes him run super fast.
He injects himself every day in a thigh.
How old is he? 9.
And he won't eat Mars bars. I think he's diabetic, mate. I don't... Sounds like he's got diabetes. No, he's shooting up beers. We see him doing it.
No, he is, because he's...
Once he took so many steroids, he passed out.
No, because one of the doctors...
I think he's in diabetic shock there.
His father knows one of the doctors at Withybush Hospital, and he gave him the tablets and made him super fast.
I remember when I was playing rugby, I went out with a girl over there, and her old man was a doctor. And I had this really bad hip injury for a long time. Like they call him a hip pointer, like right deep in the hip joint. It just wouldn't go away. And one day at the house, he just said, I can sort that out for you. I said, really? He said, yeah, come upstairs. And he gets this box of tricks out and gave me a shot in my hip, an injection.
Right.
Well, I was right as rain. I remember coming back telling my dad that, like, my girlfriend's dad had taken me upstairs to inject my ass. I was, like, 21 years old at the time. My dad went through the roof. But it did work, so, you know.
That's all I had to do was suck his dick.
Something about protein in it or vitamin E or something?
Zinc? Is it zinc? Yeah, a load of pineapple. Yeah. It is quite
he's
nice.
He's known as Dr. Zinc in Canada. He's Dr. Z.
Have a spoonful of cinnamon, come over here.
Dr. Z. What have you got to do? What have you got to take? I've got to drink pineapple juice 3 times a day. Apparently it makes a difference.
And this is really nice for about 5 minutes and then my hip feels pain.
He sucks all the lactic acid out of me. Dr. Z. Oh, God.
Sucking him out his dick to get rid of a hip issue.
I'd be fair to him. He took my mind right off my hip.
For about 5 minutes or so. He said a handsome boy like me shouldn't suffer from a bad hip. I've got to be honest, Dad, my hip hasn't hit me for a couple of years, but I keep going back to it.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
So to round two of clips, Mike, you're first up on this one. What have you got?
Right, yeah, I like nothing better, Steph, of an evening than to sit on my couch with maybe a cold drink and watch old episodes of Bullseye, the original Bullseye with Jim Bowen. And this, I mean, literally every episode of Bullseye, there's a highlight or two anyway. But this is one of my favourite episodes of Bullseye where... Well, just watch the reaction to the prizes that they win at the end of the game.
19. And treble 19! Yeah.
Have a look at this. It's an absolutely superb prize. Have a look at it.
Watch it. It's a bullseye fashion spree. A chance to splash out in style on a whole range of up-to-the-minute outfits from a leading fashion chain. Perhaps Dad would choose something elegantly informal, like this traditional blazer with casual check trousers and a trench-style raincoat.
There's lots of stuff to love about Bullseye. The one that always sticks in my mind is, you know, there were no drones. There was no CCTV camera in your local pub. You know, there was no surveillance to speak of. Right?
Yeah.
All you had to do is get two mates who were good at darts.
Yes.
Right. Tell the producers one of you's crap.
Yes.
And then win Bullseye.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was the massive British honesty of saying we need two players. One's got to be good at darts. One's got to be crap at darts. Right, and then people turned up that actually were crap at darts.
Yeah,
right? In a darts competition, I would just blag it. All you got to do is hit like a triple 20. Oh, I can't believe it! So, I can't even hit the
ball.
Not
another lucky right? throw.
What do you mean? So they play and that
beginner's luck. Is that what they call it? Is that the phrase beginner's luck?
Yeah. So the one fella gets up there and he literally can't hit the ball. Right? These two northern working class fellas win basically a selection of what can only be described as shit clothes.
Yeah, but shit expensive clothes.
Shit expensive clothes that you wouldn't wear in Huddersfield if your life depended on it. Yes. Right? And their face is an absolute picture. Oh. And, oh God, but Bullseye's so good. I mean,
in terms of those boys having to wear those catwalk fashions in Huddersfield in 1987 or whatever.
Wonderful.
I remember watching a documentary about glam rock with my dad, and there was an interview with it. There was an interview,
huge fan.
It was an interview with a teenage girl. She's about sort of 17 or something, and it's like 1971, and she's a big fan of Mark Bolan and T-Rex and David Bowie. And they're interviewing her outside the Shepherd's Bush Empire or something. They're saying, "So, you know, do you expect boys to wear makeup?" And she goes, it shows that they make an effort. And I would never have a boyfriend who doesn't wear makeup. I never would. I love David Bowie. I love Mark Bolan. And so this is when Dad was like 18 or 19. So I turned to Dad. I said, did he used to wear makeup then? And he went, makeup? I lived in Cross Hands. Of course I didn't wear makeup. Can you imagine me walking into Tumble Rugby Club with eyeliner on in 1971.
Well, I think there's that whole mythology about the swinging 60s as well, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I
remember thinking to my dad, this must have been some sort of, you lived some sort of halcyon days of the 60s. My God, Dad, it must have been a different world. What was it like, this, you know, swinging 60s, Carnaby Street? And my old man was an apprentice on Cardiff Docks, you know? He used to drink in a pub called The Packet. I mean,
what a pub.
It couldn't be more.
What a pub.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great pub. It's a great pub.
What I love about Bullseye is that it was a genuinely working class pastime that they just televised.
Yeah.
And
yeah, with no real whistles and bells. I mean,
I can't really think of a modern equivalent of something.
Well, there was Indoor League before that with Fred Coomer, which I bloody love.
I'll say that.
The thing was, when you watch like Blankety Blank, right? Terry Wogan made a big thing of the fact that the prizes were so shit.
Yes.
He mentioned it all the time, right? Jim Bowen, I was always being told by ITV, listen,
we've got to pick this up.
Don't take the piss now.
Yeah.
Pick this up, right? So Jim Bowen sort of toes the party line. He knows very well how terrible those prizes are.
Yeah.
Right? And he's got to go through with it. And so are the two lads playing. And I'm just thinking, you're going to look like a dick. You've won looking like a dick. There you go.
Right, Ellis, round two, what have you got?
This is one of those moments that even though I'm in no way affiliated to Hibernian Football Club, I don't support Hibs, but this just gives me goosebumps. So it is Hibs fans singing Sunshine on Leith after Hibs had won the 2016 Scottish Cup.
You saw it. You cleaned it.
Now, it's a brilliant song because it's not your typical football song for a kick-off. It's by the Proclaimers, who are big Hibs fans. And it's a ballad. So the thing with Hibs is Hibs are a big club in Scotland.
Yeah.
I would say they're probably, I think you could argue, the fourth biggest club in Scotland. Obviously, you've got the Old Firm, and then you've got Aberdeen and Hearts, maybe. But they just had this dreadful run of luck in the Scottish Cups. They hadn't won it since 1902. They'd lost 11 finals. And if you look at the records of the Scottish Cup, they tend to lose one every decade. So they're never quite good enough to cross the line. So they had won the league since 1902. They'd won the league in the 50s. They got to the semi-final of the European Cup in 1955, I think. But they just could not win the Scottish Cup. Gordon Smart, who I know quite well from Radio X, he's a big Hibs fan from Edinburgh. Yes. And he saw me tweeting about this, because it is a clip I come back to often.
Yeah.
And he said, it's the best day of my life, and I count the birth of my children in that. And I think, obviously, we're preaching to the converted here because of the nature of this podcast, but if you are one of those people who doesn't like sport, I feel sorry for you, actually, in the same way that I have met, in my time, people who just don't like music.
Yes.
People who don't like all music. So David Mitchell, the comedian, he doesn't like music. He's not interested in music.
How can you not like all music?
There was a guy who I used to work with who said, what's the point?
Yeah.
What's the point?
Well, you know...
There is no answer to that, is there?
I don't know where to begin. And I think, because of the money involved with sport, and especially sadly with football, often the violence associated with it, or even with rugby and South Wales, domestic abuse when Wales lose, all that kind of stuff, I think there are plenty of sticks to beat sport with.
Yeah.
But one of the mistakes I think sporting naysayers make is that they think that this podcast, three friends who are sport obsessive, that's all we talk about is formations and shape and technique. The fact is, it's days like that when you are there with your grandfather or with your son or with your daughter or with your mum or dad, whoever it was who took you first. It's like when I go and watch, the Swans when I go and watch Wales, for the 2 hours in the pub beforehand, I'm with 10 of my best mates.
Exactly.
Of course there's an element of talking about the game.
Yeah, but
it's not just, it would be very dry. If we were just talking about, I think we should play three centre-backs, I think, three centre-halves, and then wing-backs.
It's like your best,
you know, get them
it's like
to
your best
on.
Music gigs, Al. It's the same thing.
Exactly.
I got to see gigs as often as I can, but I'll talk about a commercial one I went to. So I went to see the Stones gig sort of 2 summers ago in Cardiff, right? What a great day.
That's
Just the whole day was amazing. And we weren't all stood in the pub singing Rolling Stones songs for 4 hours.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. The thing about sport compared to another sort of art form, in inverted commas, you risk having the worst day of your life for the chance of having the best day of your life.
Bang on, that is. I've never thought of that. That is spot on.
You don't get that with a theatre or something like that, do you?
No.
I've been to hundreds of football matches. Hundreds. A lot of them have been shit. I don't consider a second of it wasted because the really brilliant ones, Valencia nil, Swansea City 3, Wales 3, Belgium 1 at the Euros, etc, etc, etc. I still think about those. I don't think about the amazing gigs I've been in the same way that I think of Wales at the Euros. So if you think that childbirth is the best day of your life, you are ill.
Oh, it's horrendous. It is horrendous.
Oh, best day of my life. I loved it. My bird was in pain for fucking 12 hours.
Oh, yeah.
I thought she was dying at one stage.
I thought you'd lose them both at one point. It was epic day. I mean,
best
fantastic.
Day. How is that better than beating Valencia in Europa League?
She's stitched inside and outside, mine. I won't have sex for about 2 years now because he had to have forceps. It was horrific. But, I mean, what a day I was. Terrible day. Great results.
Yeah, exactly.
But the journey, it's fun.
It's winning on penalties after extra time, isn't it?
Yeah. of a horrible game.
So my clip for round number two is Nonno Ciccio. He is an Italian football fan. He's a Foggia fan. And this is one of those sort of four-minute documentaries that the guys at Copa 90 make for YouTube.
È un amore scoppiato, mi ha trasformato la vita.
So, this guy is 90 years old. He is, according to the title, the world's oldest ultra. Went to see his first game in the 30s, stole a bike to go and get there. And ever since then, he has been a Foggia fan. And what a dude. I like the fact that he has toured Italy purely on the basis of, yeah, I've been to Milan, but to watch a game.
But it's also, it's the same principle as those Hibs fans.
Yes.
Foggia, not a big club.
No, 100%.
They're not a successful club, and he's had an absolutely fantastic life.
Well, second division or...
third division, tier, yeah. But he's a 90-year-old hammering it down the motorway in his car, banging the horn.
This is gone now because the club is far better supported. When I first started going away with the Swans, there was often only a few hundred of us, and you knew everyone's faces.
You go away.
Because...
What do you mean by away?
There's only 150 of you going to Rochdale. You will know the other 149.
Yes.
Who are willing to travel to Rochdale on a Monday night.
I think the best part of that clip, and it is a great clip, it must be such an absolute tonic to be a nonagenarian and to be stood there with a bunch of young lads all shouting about the fact you can still get a boner.
Yes. Not a Ciccio has a hard cock is one of their chants. And
I mean, that is really cut to the heart of the matter there, isn't it? I mean, they appreciate that he's 90.
Yeah, and he loves
probably
football.
He's probably having erectile difficulties, right? But those lads are trying to get him through it by that. I mean, that is, you know what I mean?
I'd like to have been in the pub when they first came up with that song. They're singing all the usual.
You wonder why, you know, he must have got his dick out after a game. Must have got it out, put it on a table. I did that once. There was a young lad once in the Romilly pub in Cardiff.
I did that once.
Banging on about the fact of how big his dick was, right?
Right.
He was a real twat of a kid.
Yes.
I said, go on then, mate. Let's have a look at your dick.
Let's have a look.
He's like, whoa, you're a pervert, you mate. I said, no, not, I'm just wondering. I said, you're banging on about what a big dick you got all the time. I wouldn't mind having a look at it just to check it out. Oh, you're sick, mate. You're sick. I said, no, I'm not sick. I'm just, you're
repeating
this with these stories, right? He said, you get your dick out then. So I did. Right? I was going to get my dick out and put it on the table, right?
On the table.
I said, go on, it's your go. And he went away with a flea in his ear. So I just think, this fella here, the Foggia dude, probably was, you know, high jinks after a game, got his dick out.
Oh, you're going to be good value at the live shows, Mike.
They're not talking about his dick. They're talking about the fact that he's got a hard cock as well.
Yeah. It's actual state of the penis they're singing about, not the penis.
Exactly.
Itself.
There was a kid in school with me, and I can't tell his real name, but he was just known as Boner from the second year, which is now year eight, because he got a hard on in the showers after PE, and we just never lived it down. He was just known as Boner forever. But I wouldn't have thought of standing at Jenner Park with Barry Towan against TNS, and shouting, you know, Boner's got a hard cock.
It's in his name.
I've started singing it about myself at games now, but no one ever joins
in. Try to convince yourself.
Oh, well, it's James. Has got a hard cock.
And it's James got a hard cock.
Come on.
It's long and thick and it's veiny.
Come on.
Come on, Izzy.
Come on.
Izzy, love. I'll cut my back, babe. Come on.
Come on, please.
Get it out then. I'll be like, oh, get it out then. Let's have a look at it.
Just a bit of fun, boys. No. I'm not getting anything out, boys, man.
I think it's Boner will know. If Boner's listened to this, and I mentioned them on Facebook, right? Very good rugby player in his day, right? He'll know what I mean.
Oh,
that's what I'm going to say.
Andrew Boner Law, the first, Scottish Prime Minister from Between the Walls.
That was his actual name, was it?
Andrew Boner Law it was, yeah, it wasn't a nickname that he got in the House of Commons bar.
He didn't get a rock on at Prime Minister's Questions.
The dispatch box.
I can't get too close. Order! Order!
No. Yeah, sort of Herbert Asquith didn't go, have you got a...
Oh, God. Lloyd George.
Randy or Gort, he was, Lloyd George.
For it, wasn't he? Absolutely
he loved it, yeah.
He'd have been loving that. He'd have been loving that. Who'd he be watching? I don't know if he'd be watching.
What?
David Lloyd George. Got a hot cock.
Well, Lloyd George was born in Manchester, but raised in Kiev, I think, wasn't he?
Right.
I don't know, he might have gone down the Oval to watch Carnarvon. I don't know who his local club would have
been. I don't know where he went to school, because I didn't go to school in Carmarthen and all our subjects weren't about Wales.
I've just got an interest.
If you had two Welsh blokes and three Welsh blokes, what would you get? Five Welsh blokes. Correct.
That's maths done for today, boys.
Yeah. Maths done. Science. I'm in Caesus. It's -3. Oh, fuck off. Honestly.
Oh, I mean, yes. I would say that my knowledge base is very, very deep, very narrow.
I always felt less Welsh. So I'm from Barry, so it was. I mean, Barry's really, it's like a mini Cardiff, isn't it? It's
yeah.
Got its own sort of accent. We didn't ever feel particularly, we felt Welsh, but not Welsh, if you know what I mean.
I mean, this is a probably a subject for a different podcast. But I would say it's a problem that Welsh nationalism faces that Scottish nationalism doesn't face or hasn't faced. Because it was seen as a linguistic thing rather than and maybe an economic thing.
But anyway, back to the old fellow with the big dick.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Let's round things off then with books for this week. Alice, what have you gone for this week?
My book is Living on the Volcano, The Secrets of Surviving as a Football Manager by Michael Calvin. Forward by Arsene Wenger. It was shortlisted for 2015 William Hill Sports Book of the Year. It is absolutely tremendous, and what an insight into the pressures faced by modern managers and the scrutiny you're under and the incredibly long hours and how stressful it is. I'd love to be involved in football. I love football. There wasn't a sentence in this book that made me think that being a manager sounded good. Admittedly, if you're someone like Mark Hughes and you're at the level where you're continually employed by Premier League teams and then you get sacked before the end of your contract and then you get the big payoff, so he's earned, you know, millions for not fulfilling his contract, then yes, obviously it is more difficult to feel sympathy for someone like that. But certainly, once you're below Championship level, they're not earning big money, but it's such a precarious job. It's a really fascinating book, and Michael Calvin in particular is a very, very good writer. So he wrote The Nowhere Men about scouts and scouting, which I will do as a book, one of my book choices, no doubt. But if you're interested in what it's like to be a manager, I can't think of a better insight than the one provided by Living on the Volcano.
Right, Mike, what have you got?
Right, well, I like American things, as we know. So this week's book is called Bringing the Heat by a chap called Mark Bowden. So Mark Bowden is going to spend a season with the Philadelphia Eagles. Right before the preseason starts, one of the main characters in the book, a book called Jerome Brown, gets killed in a car crash. So the book takes a very different turn, right? So, and the fact that happened right before the sort of book starts influences it a lot, and it's a real warts and all book about the league, about football. But I just think Mark Bowden writes really well. I know that Al likes, and you, Steph, like people to write really well. I'm just going to read this a little bit. It's quite long, so I do apologise. I'll try and put my best reading voice on. Most of the NFL's 28 head coaches were former marginal players who became devotees of the cult. Unlike the other meatheads who played until their knees gave out and then turned back into oversized job seekers in ill-fitting suits with pathetic pre-middle-aged limps, coaches were football lifers. You stayed on when the money and the cheering died out. You volunteered, you carried water buckets, picked up towels you had to until you latched onto an assistant's job at some small college, trying to turn high school flashes into real football players.
getting paid a pittance but still possessing enough of the old pro aura to hold the kids in thrall. That might lead to an unpaid assistant position on a pro staff. Then after a season or two, maybe coach of a special team or a tight end or a wide receivers. Haunting the locker rooms and film rooms and weight rooms, a monk in the sweaty temple of true manhood. Watching your kid brother, say, the one who always envied you, who turned green in the stands watching you don the holy pads for a weekend battle, now promoted to his own high-rise office with a secretary and an expense account, while you're working 80, 90, 100 hours a week in humid, smelly basement rooms under crumbling stadiums, never seeing the wife and kids, enduring the daily tedium of practices, squinting at game films, trying to get the superstars, now half your age, who all make, what, 100, 1,000 times your salary, trying to get them to work together well enough to actually execute one or two of the plays that existed with such subtle clarity in your mind's eye. All for the privilege of still being out there on game day, on the sidelines maybe, but definitely still in it, still part of the game, soaking up the blood-quickening roar of the fans who, individually were the lowest of the low, but who collectively were the very fountain, the wellspring of everything that mattered, toughing it out year after year, decade after decade, until there came at long last your chance. The mitre, in this case a headset, was placed on your head, the whistle draped around your neck, the ever-present pack of local reporters went to work, creating your legend, immortalising your oddities of expression or habit, which later would be shown as proof either of your genius or your unfitness, depending on how many games you could win. And lo, you had arrived, anointed, one of the 28 NFL head coaches, a high holy priest of the pigskin.
Oof.
The whole book is like that. So, bring in the heat. A pro football team's quest for glory, fame, immortality and a bigger piece of the action by Mark Bowden.
So I've gone for a book that if you ask people what's the best sports book, 8 out of 10 will say The Fight by Norman Mailer.
Because I've read it. I love this book. And it's been on my list. I was going to do it over the next few weeks because it is a fantastic read.
I just think it's extraordinary in many different ways. Because the way he sort of opens himself up to accusations of being racist. To go to the Rumble in the Jungle and put yourself at the heart of the book is a phenomenal decision to have made. You've gone to the best one of the boxing and gone, this is about Norman. But it's just beautifully written and the style of it is fantastic and I like all the potential conundrums it sort of throws up in your head about whether it's all right to kind of like him a bit.
I would really recommend The Fight. It is absolutely brilliant. But he punched or headbutted, I think he might have punched Gore Vidal because they had a big rivalry.
Brilliant.
Imagine Norman Mailer seeing that, punching Gore Vidal.
I just love the idea that there are all these great writers who've turned up. Because George Plimpton, who's one of my favourite American journalists...
I was going to pick that one next week.
He's fantastic and I love his stuff. He writes about this fight, and Hunter S. Thompson never makes it out of the hotel to the fight. he's been sent out there to cover it for an American magazine, and he just sits by the pool getting drunk. Right, if you want to get in touch with us, leave us a review, 5-star review on wherever you are getting your podcast from. If you want to have a guess at who the secret guitarist is, it's playing underneath us now. You can have a guess, as long as you give us a 5-star review. If you want your free beers, the deal is still on beer52.com/distant. If you want to get in touch with us directly, Distant Pod on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. And if you want to see the playlist with all the clips we talked about today, youtube.com/thesociallydistantsportsbar is where you need to go.